Welcome to the Deep Dive. It's April 21st, 2025, and we're ready to jump into some of the big stories lighting up the Hacker News front page today.
Absolutely. We've got a really interesting selection, actually. Covers a lot of ground from like hardware hacking nostalgia to open source drama, language features, and even some regulatory action.
It's quite the mix. Okay, so the articles we're looking at are Getting Forked by Microsoft, then Python's New T-Strings, also Blog Hosted on a Nintendo Wii, a Show HN for something called DIA, which is an open weights TTS model, and finally, FTC takes action against Uber.
Yeah, see?
Wow.
A real grab bag. But, you know, there's some interesting threads connecting these, I think. Some common themes about innovation, ethics, big tech, stuff like that.
Definitely. And we're going to try and pull those threads out for you. So let's start with maybe the most surprising one. Blog Hosted on a Nintendo Wii. I mean, you see that. You got to click.
Oh, for sure. The blog's at infected.systems, by the way. And yeah, got quite a bit of attention on HN. Lots of comments.
And the first thing people noticed was this image, right? SSL added and removed here.
Right. Yeah, that's a nod to the 2013 NSA leaks, specifically about Google's internal traffic between data centers not being encrypted back then. It's that kind of, you know, inside baseball tech humor.
A little wink for those who remember, but beyond the joke, just hosting anything on a Wii is, well, it's impressive. That thing has, what, 24 megabytes of RAM?
Yeah, 24 megabit. Compare that to, say, the Xbox 360 from around the same time, which had 512 megabit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real testament to what you can squeeze out of limited hardware.
Really is. And the Hacker News comments went into the technical side, like network performance.
Mm-hmm. Someone pointed out the blogger isn't actually using Nintendo's own TCP stack, which is, let's be honest, notoriously terrible.
Huh. Yeah, anyone who's tried serious online gaming on Nintendo consoles probably felt that pain.
Exactly. It sparked this whole side conversation about Nintendo's historically bad networking. Someone even shared an old story about working on some obscure Nintendo feature like 10 years ago with Offerium services.
Oh, man. And it's not totally fixed, is it? I saw the current advice for the Switch is still to open, like, this huge range of UDP ports.
Yeah, it's wild. Like ports 1024 all the way up to 65535. Just open everything, I guess.
Crazy. Okay, so back to the Wii blog. What about reliability? Running on an old SD card seems risky.
Yeah, that came up. The suggestion was to use a USB thumb drive after you do the initial, you know, exploit to get NetBSD running. But then you hit another snag.
Which is?
The Wii only has USB 2.0 ports. So maybe not the speediest solution, but probably more reliable than an old SD card.
Gotcha. And there was some random Mac tip in there, too. Something about photo boot.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
The image flipping issue. Apparently, the fix is to use QuickTime Player and do a create new movie recording instead. Classic weird workaround.
Huh. Okay. So despite all this, how's it actually performing? Is the Wii struggling?
Surprisingly, no. The reported load average was super low, like 0.06 over 15 minutes, which is basically idle.
Wow. How do we know that?
There's a status page blog.infected.systemstatus. It's apparently just updated by a simple shell script running on a cron job every 15 minutes. So the stats might be a tiny bit out of date sometimes, but it gives you the picture.
Okay, this is cool. It makes you wonder, could you go even older? Like, could you host a site on an original NES?
Huh. Well, that's where things get really tricky.
Yeah.
The NES has, what, 2 kilobytes of RAM? And the CPU is just way too basic, no memory management unit.
So probably not.
Well, maybe not a blog.
Oh,
you can theoretically serve super basic HTTP 1.0, maybe some simple CGI stuff. But even the old Famicom network system add-on needed extra hardware just for the modem. The RAM is the killer.
But someone's probably tried, right? The homebrew scene is nuts.
Oh, absolutely. There are projects like NES 64 trying to run Commodore 64 OS on it.
Mm.
And there's even talk of porting Linux NG, which does have an experimental web server, by using the Famicom disk system for extra RAM.
Whoa!
So theoretically,
yeah,
maybe a super, super minimal HTTP 1.0 server. Pushing it, though.
Okay, back to the Wii, then. How are they handling modern stuff like HTTPS? The Wii itself isn't doing TLS, surely.
No, no. They're using Caddy as a reverse proxy. So Caddy sits in front, handles the TLS encryption with your browser, and then talks plain HTTP to the Wii running LightTPD, which is a lightweight web server.
Smart. Okay. And any idea how they made that cool Wii ASCII art on the page?
Nope. That seems to be a trade secret for now.
Fair enough. Any other interesting nuggets from the discussion?
Yeah, someone suggested using a VM as another layer of proxy just to avoid exposing your home IP address directly from the potentially vulnerable Wii. Good security practice.
Makes sense. And good news for preservationists, that's already archived on the Wayback Machine.
Yep. And the author's final thoughts were interesting too. They said it worked better than expected, but rebooting the OS, NetBSD, actually reboots the whole console.
Meaning
you need the Wiimote and the sensor bar connected to actually like operate your web server if it needs a restart.
Yeah.
Your gaming gear becomes server peripherals.
That's amazing. What a great example of just tinkering for the sake of it, pushing old tech.
It really is. Okay, let's switch gears quite dramatically now from hobbyist ingenuity to big tech and open source, getting forked by Microsoft.
Right. This one definitely caused a stir. The maintainer of an open source project, Spagel, felt, what was the phrase? Forked, but not really.
Yeah, that's the one. So the story goes, a Microsoft director reached out, talked about collaboration. They ended up signing a consulting agreement. The maintainer did a two-day workshop, got paid. Sounds okay so far.
That sounds like a positive interaction, potentially.
Right. But then later, Microsoft released their own project called Peered. And this Spagel maintainer felt it was basically a fork of their work, but done without proper attribution or any further collaboration, despite that initial workshop.
Ouch. So they feel like Microsoft just took their code after picking their brain.
That seems to be the feeling. They mentioned it feels like a competitor now. And sometimes users even ask them for help with the Microsoft version. It really touches on that power dynamic between individual maintainers and massive companies.
Yeah, I can see that. But Spagel is MIT licensed, isn't it? Which is pretty permissive.
It is. The MIT license basically says you can do almost anything with the code, fork it, modify it, use it commercially, as long as you keep the original copyright notice and the permission notice intact.
So the debate is whether Microsoft did keep those notices.
Exactly. The discussion on Hacker News got into the weeds a bit.
Yeah.
Like, is just having a license file at the root enough? Or should you have copyright headers in the actual source files, especially if you make changes? Standard practice varies, but headers make attribution clearer if the commit history isn't perfectly preserved in the fork.
And did Peered have the attribution initially?
Well, the claim was that they initially removed the original author's name and put Microsoft's name there. But importantly, someone found a later commit where it seems like they added some attribution back.
Ah, okay. So maybe an oversight corrected? Or maybe a reaction to the post?
Hard to say for sure. Which leads to the bigger question everyone was debating. What was the real intent behind that collaboration meeting? Genuine interest or just information gathering for an internal project?
Yeah, that's the core of it, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And the advice floating around HN was basically, maintainers, be cautious with big tech approaches, prefer public contributions on GitHub, you know, over private meetings, unless the terms are crystal clear. There's definitely still skepticism about the whole Microsoft loves open source thing.
It's that classic tension, right? Open source is about sharing and building on others' work.
Exactly. Some argue you should just be happy the code is being used, full stop. The knowledge sharing is the point. But that often bumps up against the expectation of proper credit, which is part of the MIT license. For a lot of devs, that recognition matters.
The maintainer talked about maybe changing the license for Spagel going forward.
Yeah, they could change it for future versions, maybe to something like the GPL or a dual license to control commercial use better. But it wouldn't affect the code Microsoft already forked under the MIT license.
Oh.
That ship has sailed. Shows how important that initial license choice is.
Right. Choosing the license up front is critical.
Definitely. Other things came up too, like an unverified anecdote about the Microsoft engineer involved getting promoted around that time. Who knows if it's related, but it adds to the intrigue.
And the idea of keeping clean source.
Yeah, the practice of deliberately not looking at competing code bases when you're building something similar to avoid any unconscious borrowing or potential IP issues down the line.
Makes sense. And the whole stole versus copied debate.
Right. Legally under MIT, it's copying. But many argue that removing attribution feels like stealing the credit, even if the code itself was permissively licensed. It's ethical gray area, I guess.
Definitely seems like this case hit a nerve in the open source community. Lots to unpack there.
For sure. Okay, let's move on to a language feature discussion. Python's new T-strings.
T-strings, okay. They're being called Python's version of JavaScript's tag templates. What's the problem they're trying to solve?
Basically, safety. They want a more secure way to handle string interpolation. You know, putting variables inside strings, especially for things like building SQL queries or generating HTML, where you can easily introduce injection vulnerabilities if you're not careful.
Right, like SQL injection or cross-site scripting. So how are these T-strings different from the F-strings Python already has?
The key idea is that a T-string would be a distinct type, not just a regular string like an F-string becomes after evaluation. This means functions, like maybe your database library's execute function, could recognize them.
And do what with them? Check them somehow?
Potentially, yeah. They could maybe reject them if they look unsafe or handle them differently, maybe even enable some static analysis tools to check for problems before you even run the code.
Okay. That sounds useful. Because even with existing safe ways, like parameterized queries...
Right. Parameterized queries are the gold standard for SQL safety. Select from users where is.
Yeah.
But people sometimes forget, or maybe they reach for an F string like db.execute, F query where name user input, without thinking.
And boom, vulnerability.
Exactly. The hope with T strings is that maybe you'd have to explicitly mark input as safe, like db.execute, T query where name E is input. It makes the dangerous path harder to take accidentally.
Gotcha. Did the HN discussion touch on Python's lack of compile time checks generally?
Oh yeah, that's a long-standing thing. People wish Python caught more errors before runtime. T-strings aren't a magic bullet for that, but they fit into this broader theme of wanting more robust checking, maybe enabling better static analysis.
But adding features like this always sparks the Python is getting too complex debate, doesn't it?
Always. You definitely saw comments saying Python's becoming bloated, and people expressing love for simpler languages like Go that are more resistant to adding tons of features. The whole generics debate came up again, too.
Right. And how do these compare syntactically to JavaScript's tag templates?
Well, JS tag templates look like tag string stuff.
Yeah.
An important point raised was that in JS, even tag templates are still fundamentally strings and work fine without a tag. T-strings in Python seem envisioned as something potentially more distinct.
Could you just do this with a library in Python?
Maybe partially. Someone suggested using the inspect module to look at the caller's context, but the consensus seemed to be that a dedicated language feature would be more powerful and integrated.
And, inevitably, the Python 2 versus 3 discussion popped up again.
You know it. Even though Python 3 is, what, 17 years old now? Python 2.7 only hit end of life 5 years ago? People are still migrating code. It's a reminder that these big transitions take a long time.
Yeah, tech history has long tails. Okay, let's shift again. From code to consumers. FTC takes action against Uber. What's going on here?
Right. The Federal Trade Commission is going after Uber, alleging deceptive practices related to their Uber One subscription service, specifically around billing and cancellation.
Okay, deceptive is a strong word from the FTC. What are the main accusations?
Well, the FTC chair said they're fighting back against unwanted subscriptions and making cancellation too hard. The specific allegations against Uber fall into a few buckets.
Let's hear them.
First, deceptive savings claims. They apparently advertised saving $25 a month with Uber One, but didn't properly account for the subscription cost itself, which is up to 10 bucks a month. And they allegedly hid the real details in tiny gray text.
Sneaky.
And maybe worse, some people claimed they were signed up without even consenting, sometimes without even having an Uber account.
Wow, okay, what else?
Second, premature billing. People on free trials were supposedly charged before the trial ended, even though Uber promised free cancellation during the trial.
It's annoying.
And third, the cancellation process itself. The FTC claims it could take up to 23 screens and 32 actions to cancel Uber One.
23 screens? That's insane.
Right. They also allege Uber used tactics to dissuade people asking why, pushing pauses instead of cancellations, offering incentives. Some were told to contact support but weren't given contact info, and others claim they were charged after requesting cancellation while waiting for support.
That sounds like a nightmare. Definitely like those dark patterns people talk about. What did the Hacker News crowd say? Did these stories resonate?
Oh, big time. The comments were full of people sharing similar frustrations. Endless loops with support over incorrect charges, people unable to use Uber because of old chargeback balances.
Yeah.
And that claim about Uber Cash users getting quoted higher ride prices, that came up multiple times. People saying they did side-by-side checks with colleagues, saw it on Reddit.
Yeah.
They felt penalized for having Uber credit.
That seems really shady, if true.
It does. There was discussion about dynamic pricing in general, some defending it, others calling it exploitative. People also mentioned trouble using Uber credits, not just getting charged more. And yeah, that cancellation process was a huge point of agreement. Classic dark pattern design.
Any other specific complaints?
Issues with Uber Eats delivery times being way off, prices jumping up right at confirmation, difficulty getting reliable ride wait times because of premium pay to not wait features. Some people even shared their extreme cancellation tactics, like just lying to support or doing chargebacks, but knowing the risks getting banned. Someone compared the retention tactics to a faith-based health sharing program they tried to leave.
Wow. It really sounds like the FTC complaint tapped into a lot of pent-up user frustration.
It really does. Lots of mentions of poor support, people looking for alternatives. That theory about Uber Cash from Amex Gold leading to higher prices kept popping up too.
So what happens now with the FTC complaint?
Well, the FTC files a complaint when they have reason to believe a law is being broken and it's in the public interest. Now it goes to court to be decided.
Okay, one last thing from the HN front page. Show HN Daya, an open weights TTS model for generating realistic dialogue. Tell us about this.
All right, so show HN means someone sharing their own project. Daya is a text-to-speech TTS model. Key things here are open weights and realistic dialogue.
Open weights meaning?
Meaning the model's trained parameters, the sort of brain of the AI, are publicly available. Unlike many commercial AI models where that stuff is kept secret, this lets others build on it, inspect it, use it more freely.
And realistic dialogue suggests it's focused on sounding natural, conversational, not robotic.
Exactly. That seems to be the specific goal here, making AI-generated speech sound more like real people talking to each other.
Cool. So for listeners interested in AI, speech tech, this is definitely something to check out on Hacker News. The open nature is a big plus for the community.
Absolutely. It's part of that whole exciting wave of open AI development we're seeing.
Okay, well, that wraps up our deep dive for today, April 21st, 2025. We went from hacking a Nintendo Wii to run a blog.
To the complexities of open source licenses and collaborating with tech giants.
The ongoing evolution of Python with things like T-strings.
And finally, the regulatory spotlight turning onto Uber's subscription practices.
It's really a snapshot of the tech world, isn't it? All the innovation, the friction points, the ethical questions kind of bubbling up.
Definitely. It shows how interconnected everything is, the tools we build, how we share them, how companies use them, and how regulators try to keep up.
So maybe final thought for you to chew on. In this digital world that's just getting more complex and connected, how do we find that right balance? You know, between fostering that amazing innovative spirit we see in things like the Wii blog or open source and ensuring that companies act ethically and consumers are protected, like the FTC is trying to do with Uber.
It's the big question, really. No easy answers. But hopefully digging into these stories gives you some food for thought. We definitely encourage you to check out the articles and the Hacker News discussions yourself if any of this sparked your interest.
Absolutely. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.